Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am Jason Dingus. This is Lost Rhetoric, a dim space for light hearts where we discuss all manner of odd. This week, Andy Sell from Ghoul School, a horror history podcast, will be joining me. He's the host of that show. If you haven't checked it out, do yourself a favor and listen to it. It's great. This week, we're going to be talking about the McPherson tape. Now, what is that? Well, it's two movies. It was started out as one, then there was a remake. Neither of them were called the McPherson tape, but now both of them are referred to as the McPherson tape, depending on who you talk to. But we're going to get into that. And it's a found footage style movie about a family that gets abducted by aliens. Now, there's a lot of lore behind not only the making of the movie or movies, but, I mean, there's conspiracy theories about it, and there's a lot of ideas about it, and it influenced a lot of movies that came after it, because this is kind of the first. This is one of the first found footage films made in this way. It influenced Blair Witch and Cloverfield and anything that came after it. And it's kind of undeniable. But it's a really, really cool story. And I hope you stick around for it. But before we get into that, let's talk about last week, episode 44 with Eris Hunter Wales. We discussed a few songs that we thoroughly enjoy that were extraterrestrial in nature, either, you know, based on a historical event that didn't happen to the artist, or it was a song influenced by their personal experience. And it was a super fun episode to do, and I'm glad he did it with me, and I hope you listened to it, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you haven't listened to it, go back and check it out. It was really, really fun, and I plan on doing similar kind of episodes in the future. But let's get into the top five. Who listened to that episode the most? Coming in at number five, Los Angeles, California. Number four, Richmond, Virginia. Number three, Portland, Oregon. Number two, Columbus, Ohio. And back on top at number one, Aloha, Oregon. So thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. Couldn't do it without you. And I have a favor to ask. If you could, spread the word a little bit. Send a link to your favorite episode, or just send a link to LostRhetoric.com and tell your friends about it. And if you run across anyone that's asking for podcast suggestions, maybe throw Lost Rhetoric out there. You know, just to help spread the word a little bit. I would really appreciate it. I feel like my social media reach is just, it's whatever. It's small. I can only do so much. So if you could help out, I would greatly, greatly appreciate it. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends you do. That would be amazing. And write me and tell me how it goes. Or tell your friends to write me and tell me how it goes. Maybe they can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or rate and review. That'd be great too. Feel free to do that if you haven't already. But before I get off on a tangent on that, let's get into what I'm listening to. This week, it's all about the ladies. I was listening to the new Wild Powers album. That's Powers with two W's. They have a brand new album out called What You Wanted on Nadine Records, which is a local record label here in Portland, Oregon, run by the amazing Mandy Morgan. The album just came out. This band it's two ladies and one dude. and they're great. They're from Seattle. They're sad. They're happy. They're angry. They're funny and curious. They're an awesome band. I mean, they're like grunge. They're grunge rock. I don't fucking know, man. They play rock and roll really well, and in a varying amount of styles to perfection, I think. It's a great record, so check out Wild Powers, What You Wanted. Big Brave has a new album called Vital, And they're on Southern Lord Records. They're from Montreal. They're female fronted as well. And they're like beautiful sludge music, you know, just super heavy, but with the really gorgeous vocals. Funny story. I was listening to this record, not the record. I don't own the record yet, but I was listening to the album, and my son was getting really excited, and he started kind of headbanging. He kind of started throwing his head on the couch cushions with his arms up and just throwing himself down and smiling. He would run up to the speaker and point at it. And he's not talking yet, but he was getting really excited. So I started headbanging with him. And then he came over to the armrest of the couch and slammed his head right between his eyes, right into it. And as we all know, most armrests aren't cushioned. So to his credit, it hurt, but he didn't cry. I think he was still too juiced up on the music and how good it is. So there it is. You know, Big Brave is gonna make the 2-year-olds do some silly stuff, but they'll be happy about it. They're just too excited about the music coming out of the speakers. So yeah, check out that record, Vital, by Big Brave. And the last band I've been listening to, a total dedication to Andy Sell, my guest tonight, No Man is a fucking awesome band. The reason why it's dedicated to Andy Sell is because he is a huge Majority Rule fan. And if you haven't listened to Majority Rule, they are great. This band is all three members of Majority Rule, with one new member who is a lady. Her name is Maha Shami, which is a fucking great name. So yeah, it's basically Majority Rule with a female singer. And they got a couple albums out. One's called Devil's Cast No Shadows from 2018, and one from 2020 called Erase on their own label called Quit Life. So, yeah, that, and their the description of who or what they sound like on their, I got on their Spotify bio, and it's perfect. It says, blending mean, chaotic punk that occasionally comes up for air with haunting melodic breaks. So, yeah, that's exactly what they sound like. And, yeah, if you know Majority Rule, you kind of know what to expect. But anyway, that's what I've been listening to. So check out No Man, Big Brave, and Wild Powers. You won't be disappointed. And you can find all this on the Spotify playlist by searching LR045, or you can go to LostRhetoric.com, click on the episode, and the player will be there for you. And you can also find the shop where I'm selling merchandise, t-shirts, mugs, pins. I got something else. Oh yeah, koozies. In every order, I'm going to send free stickers to you. And thank you to everyone that's actually bought something. It makes me so happy when I get an order coming in and I get to package it up and send it out to you guys. So check it out and let me know what you think. And if you like something, you know, buy it. Now let's get into the exhumed excerpt from the Tomb of the Promulgated. This week, I got a story from October 21st. 1977 in Fostoria, Ohio, and it's titled Very Close Encounter with C&O Train. So at 3:20 a.m., the engineer by the name of Howard was sitting in his locomotive cab when several boxcars had been cut loose and were parked to the south of the switch track to a warehouse. The rest of the cars were being moved into position within the warehouse. He was facing south and noticed what looked to be a shooting star to the west, which curved down out of the northwest. The light came down in the field toward Route 23 between him and a church. Slowly, at about the speed of a walking man, it came toward him across the field. It was approximately 16 feet off the ground and stopped on the other side of the tracks between 4 and 5 boxcar lengths away, 180 to 270 feet in length. he picked up his radio and called out to his conductor, who was about 7 or 8 car lengths down the track. "Donald, come up to the engine," he said. Donald replied by radio and asked what was happening. Howard answered, "Hey, we got a GD UFO up here." By this time, the UFO had moved to within 2 car lengths of the track. The object was birthday cake, or disc-shaped, about 90 feet in diameter and 45 feet high. It was brightly lit with banks of 9 vertical tubes separated by a dark void space that reflected no light. Short horizontal tubes ran over the top and bottom of these voids. The bottom of the disc could be seen. It appeared like ceramic and was, quote, "the color of a common kind of knife sharpening stone, gray with a trace of lavender," unquote. That's a really good description. No windows, ladders, antenna, or markings of any sort were observed. There was no sound associated with the disc. The disc was slightly tilted and rotating counterclockwise. Both Howard and Donald used their railroad stopwatches twice to time the speed of rotation. The speed was 9 RPM. The object glowed yellow. Blue electric-like energy arcs ran around the disc in a clockwise direction. As the arc touched the tubes lit up. When the center of the tubes were touched, the ends lit up. When the ends of the tubes were touched by the arcs, the centers lit up. At one point, the tower operator in Fostoria, hearing radio conversation between the three men, called and asked, "Hey, Howard, you got a UFO out there?" Howard replied, "Yes, Merv, we got a UFO up here. He's damn close." Merv then asked, "Do you want the cops up there?" The reply was, "No, they can't drive up to where we're at. And if they do get here, they'll probably shoot at it. It isn't hurting anybody. We're playing games with it." Howard turned on his train cab headlight for a 2 count and then turned it off. The object lit up very bright for a similar period of time and then dimmed down. He turned his light up twice and then turned it off again. The object reacted in kind and then dimmed down. Testing his engine, a General Motors Model 3900, he increased the output to 1500 amps. The engine worked. The object did not respond. The walkie-talkies worked, as did the base radio on the train. After about 22 minutes, the object started spinning faster and faster and got as bright as it had earlier when it responded to Howard's headlight signals. Suddenly, without a sound, it took off up and to the northwest until it looked like a yellow star. Whoa, that's one of the best descriptions of a craft I've ever heard. That was great. It sounded gorgeous, didn't it? It sounded like a really pretty craft. And they were communicating with it. They were playing fucking Simon Says with the thing, like Close Encounters, you know, for a second there, it seemed. Cool fucking report right there. If you got anything from Fostoria, Ohio, or Ohio in general, write me. Let me know. I would love to hear from you. And that's the Exhumed excerpt for the week, everyone. Let's get into this interview. It's a really fun discussion I had with Andy, and I'm not going to say any more. Here it is. Well, Andy, I'm glad you're here with me.
Jason! How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I'm feeling, I feel like every week I say the same thing. I'm feeling a bit flustered. I feel like this was like really going up to the last second for me. I really crammed in a lot of stuff like the two minutes before we started recording. So,
yeah, well, there's a lot. There's a lot of information to sort through in this. And here's the thing that's crazy about it. There's still a lot of information we don't know.
Like about the, what aspects are you talking about?
Well, like how the footage ever got released. Like who got their hands on it and distributed it.
Right. Like the original tapes.
Yeah.
Well, just so no one's lost real quick. I'm going to mention it in the intro so people will know, but my guest tonight, Andy Sell.
Hi.
Hello, Andy. Hello. From the Ghoul School podcast, a horror history podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about the McPherson tape and the subsequent remake, or the whatever. We'll get into the names of
confusing.
Yeah, that is confusing. But you did your whole first episode of your podcast a couple of years ago on this very same subject. So you've already been through it, and you still don't know what's going on.
I still don't know what's going on. I still learned new stuff in doing some research for this episode that I did not know when I did my episode. So there is I have new information that I did not have back then.
Okay, great. Well, I guess we got to set a scene, you know? This McPherson tape, it's so fucking crazy considering what it was intended to be and then what it became in real life. The real life story just made it more believable.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how fucking lucky our genius is, Dean Alioto, the creator, director of this. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, he's either a genius or he's incredibly lucky. He does sometimes refer to himself as the Forrest Gump of found footage in that he kind of, you can tell he likes the attention he gets for it, but he also does have this humility about it where he's like, no, I was just lucky. Like,
right.
I accidentally created an entirely new format, narrative, genre, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. The way he talks about it is pretty, he gets a kick out of it. He says that. Yeah. He's like, I laughed at pretty much every theory that I've ever heard. And I laugh at anything that's ever come of this outside of whatever it being my first film. And it, you know, he wasn't super proud of it at first. Now he is, I think, very proud of it.
So when he made this, that's what I was going to say, was that either he's incredibly brilliant or he's lucky, or a combination of those two, or he is a government agent meant to distract us from the truth.
Exactly.
Filmmaker, film visionary, or lucky guy, or man in black. That's Dean Alioto.
It could be one, none, or all of them. I mean, who knows? I mean, so this the first film, the main let's just say the better one.
It was
made in 1987, correct?
I think he might have started production on it in 87. I believe it was finished in 89.
Okay.
And he had his first premiere of it. The first screening was in 89.
Okay.
And that's the one, I guess, Jacques Vallée went to that.
Mm-hmm.
The internet pioneer guy.
Right.
Went to that screening because I guess he's into UFOs. So yeah, it was made in 89. Dean Alioto was 25 years old. He had recently, I believe, dropped out of two film schools and was just kind of, he was about to turn 25 and he was like, I want to make my first film. I haven't made a film yet. So he was getting super eager to do it. And he had a friend, and I'm assuming that's this guy, Joseph Tognieri, mm-hmm. who gave him $6,500,
mm-hmm.
and said, here's a budget. And Dean Alioto was like, well, that's not a budget. But you know, I can make a video with this. And his intent was to sort of make, you know, kind of a calling card with this, like a videotape, you know, that he could show to people to be like, this is what I'm capable of doing.
Right.
And but also wanted to secure distribution for it,
mm-hmm.
and made it, I can't remember how long it took. I think it was over a weekend. in San Francisco, up in Northern California is where he shot it, even though it's, everybody says it's supposed to take place in Connecticut.
Right. Yeah. That was confusing to me because I think he says they shot it as a oneer in one night.
It was a oneer. I know that there is a cut in the film that you can see, mm-hmm. but I think he does also say at times that it is a one take.
Right.
It was shot in real time. So it's not like, but they must have done tons of rehearsals, you know?
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no way to he pull said, this kind of stuff off with improvisational actors without some kind of.
Yeah, he said they rehearsed for a week in San Francisco.
Okay, yeah, that's it.
And he was talking about how, yeah, they were kind of running around the streets, you know. It was pretty funny because I listened to that. What is it? The found footage files. Found footage files.
Yeah,
podcast
that's a good
interview.
Yeah, that's a really good episode. Yeah.
And yeah, he was talking about how they were running around the streets of San Francisco acting like they were being abducted by aliens, which he was like, that's kind of par for the course in the city. So,
yeah, like, nobody cares.
No one really cared. And then they went and shot it in the hills of Northern California at a house that he said cost them $100. So that's cheap for a location.
Yeah, especially in Northern California. This is before the tech boom, I guess.
Right. Yeah, so... that's of that $6,500. He said they actually came in under $6,500.
That's wow.
That's pretty amazing. Some of that money was just to travel. It wasn't even on actual production equipment or people or anything, you know?
Yeah, most of their money went to the folks that built the spaceship. The guy that built the space, I think it was literally like one person.
Yeah, and that guy's, I think it was like $750,
yeah,
is what the budget was for that. And this guy's name, I think it was Bill Bowes, if I'm right. Yeah, Bill Bowes. And this guy who built the spaceship, which I thought looked great, the way
it looked bad,
yeah, the way that they shot it. Totally yeah. sold it, and you only see the face of it, you know. But this guy, Bill Bowes, ended up being like a production designer and kind of mm-hmm. art department guy for like Tim Burton, and you know, he did some big budget stuff in the future. But this video, this movie, according to Dean Alioto, was made. Yes, he wanted to make his first film by 25, like his heroes, like Coppola and fucking Spielberg and all that stuff. But he seriously kind of created this, I don't know, this kind of genre in a sense, out of necessity and what he says was total desperation.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of the things that we kind of associate with found footage as like narrative devices now, or narrative tropes even. Mm-hmm. Conventions often now mm-hmm. were things that he used as, you know, production devices, like budget devices. So, mm-hmm. you know, he had to do, you know, the idea of having it all as a one-er because he couldn't cut, you know, really having the camera be used as a light source.
Right.
And just things like that are like, and even as his directing style, you know, how he was directing from behind the camera.
Yeah, he played the middle or the little brother,
Michael. Yeah,
that was filming the whole thing. So it's Dean Alioto operating the camera, doing all the voice acting, but he was also directing and giving cues during the one long take. So he was doing everything at once.
Yeah.
It's pretty
so
amazing.
So he would have like an AD on a walkie or something, or have like a system set up to let them know, or mm-hmm. would even had vocal cues that he would give the actors, or camera movement cues, where if he moved the camera away from a scene, they would know, okay, this scene's over, onto the next one.
Right.
And also just as getting a performance that he wanted, he would get more intense as an actor in the scene to sort of force the other actors to get more intense if they weren't giving him performance-wise what he was looking for.
Right. Yeah. So it's pretty amazing that, I mean, what director's dream is to not have their voice heard during the movie, basically directing in a way.
Yeah. You know?
Like, I mean, the guy really did it all. And he shot it on, he says, 8mm video stereo, which was like brand new at the time. Mm-hmm. It was like cutting edge. And he was so stoked. Like he says a quote, he's like, "Oh my God, I'm so lucky to be using this camera."
Yeah.
Which is in hindsight fucking hilarious. But at the time, you know, I mean, the best for what he can do. Mm-hmm. So
well, and it was supposed to have taken place even earlier. Like it takes place in 1983.
Takes place in 1983,
6 years earlier. So it's like he's, you know, even by those standards, it's like we can't really ask the, you know, questions of like, well, why are you still filming this? Or why is he filming the food on his plate? Or why is he filming this light? It's like, well, that's what everybody did with cameras back then, because not everybody had a camera.
You filmed everything and there was no way to edit.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
At home, you know, like for the consumer, I remember playing around with VHS camcorders that my best friend used to borrow from like his aunt or uncle or something. And we'd make all sorts of videos when he had it. But we would just, you know, you just straight shoot stuff. And when you want to make a cut, you stop filming and then you start filming again. And you don't know how to edit any, you can't edit anything.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So you just kind of film whatever, man. I don't know. I felt like he did a really good job of capturing that vibe of a person that is just totally curious and in awe of the piece of technology that they're holding, and he just wants to film everything.
100%. It feels like this is part of its, you know, verisimilitude, or of its kayfabe, or of its, you know, its believability. Mm-hmm. Its credibility is that it does feel like a home movie of the time.
Absolutely.
Like there are so many moments, and there's moments, you know, where the kind of action dies down. There are a couple lulls that feel really weird where it's like, okay, after that really intense scene, now we're going to go back to just the birthday party.
Right.
And then later on when it's like, okay, now we're going to play Go Fish. And it's just kind of like, you guys have a dead fucking alien in the other room. Why are you being chill right now? But like those scenes do feel like old home movies. Like if you were to get your home movies from when you were a kid in the 1980s, they're that, you know, level of like, why do I care about this?
Right. Yeah, and it's full of the stuff. If it weren't an alien abduction, you would just fast forward through if it were like a home movie.
Yeah, but you want to see.
Oh yeah, let's get to the part where we sing happy birthday or something, you know. It's like he's filming a bunch of nonsense, but that totally makes it believable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, before we get too into all of describing too much, let's tell the story of the movie. The original title is UFO Abduction.
Yes, its original title is UFO Abduction. I don't know where the McPherson tape came from, other than that the remake, the family was called the McPhersons. But on the video, the version of it that is playing on Shudder right now.
Yeah, I watched that one.
Which is also it's what the American Genre Film Archive just released through Vinegar Syndrome as a Blu-ray with Bleeding Skull. And I don't have that Blu-ray. I've like hovered. It's been in my shopping cart on a website for like a year. And I've just never pulled the trigger on it because I want to check it out. I want to see the commentary.
Right.
But so I don't know if that version on Shudder is the so-called 2017 director's cut that has extra footage and has there's not a scream at the end, right?
Scream? No, not that I.
Yeah. So I don't think this is the director. Also, from what I understand, the credits were changed for the director's cut.
Okay.
But I don't think that any version of it ever had the title McPherson tape, and that whatever elements that they used for the Shudder, whatever Shudder has, mm-hmm. has the McPherson tape title on it. That's right. That wasn't there the first time I saw it when I saw it on YouTube.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't. It was called UFO Abduction. Then, and the name of the family in this film is the Van Hees family.
The Van Hees family, yeah. Not even the McPhersons.
McPherson has nothing to do with it until the remake, which is called Alien Abduction Incident in Lake County.
Lake County, yeah.
And the name of the family, same story, basically, but the name of the family, different actors, is McPherson. And then sometime after both movies were done and the original is still like, I guess, lost.
There are holes in the story.
Yeah. It becomes the McPherson tape somehow after the sequel or the remake comes out. The original starts to become known as the McPherson tape, or they both are known as the McPherson tape. I don't really know.
Yeah, like the IMDb pages for both of them have been changed so that the official title is McPherson tape, and that didn't used to be the case.
It's so confusing.
It really is. It's very confusing.
So I watched the Shudder version, or I guess it's the original, yesterday, and the title is just the McPherson tape, and there are no McPhersons in the movie.
Yeah, no McPhersons. And I don't, they retroactively retitle a movie 10 years earlier than the movie where the McPhersons was the name. Like, there's some confusing things.
Print the legend, man.
Print the legend.
And that's exactly what it is.
I feel like there's some of that going on here.
Yeah.
Because they retroactively retitled it. It's not, like, the UFO abduction promo art I've seen in... It's on that encounter segment. I feel like if I'm bringing up the encounter segment, we kind of have to get into what happened here.
Yeah. We got to tell just really quickly the whole plot of the movie. It's pretty self-explanatory, but family gets together for their nieces, or the cameraman is a 16-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Who is actually Dean Alioto, the director. And it's their niece's, 5-year-old niece's birthday party. And they're at their mom's house. Their dad has recently passed away. He has an older brother, a middle brother, and he's the younger brother. And there's a couple wives there. Mm-hmm. And power goes out in the house. The three boys see a red light in the sky when they go to check the breaker. And they go investigate and find a spaceship with three aliens.
Yeah. And then the whole time they're like giving their brother shit for not helping out enough around the house.
Right. Yeah. And then this is one thing that's believable about the film is at one point, the Mikey, the brother that Dean Alioto plays, the cameraman, he's like, I'm going to cut the light off to save my battery.
Yeah.
And that lends to the believability of the battery lasted for an hour, which is how long the movie is.
Yeah, exactly.
And he films the whole walk through the woods, up a hill, down a hill, to the point where they see the spacecraft and the aliens. And then he films the whole run, the frantic run back where he's just yelling, holy shit, the whole time.
Holy shit, what is that? Let's go. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Did they see us?
Yeah, it's so great because one of the aliens looks in their direction, and that's when they're just like, holy fuck, let's get the fuck out of here. He saw me, you know?
Yeah.
And then he runs back into the house. And
then they go apeshit. They just grab guns and start screaming at each other.
Really long rifles.
Yeah, really long rifles. one of them is a Browning, I guess. He kept calling it the Browning. Get the Browning, load the Browning.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. I don't like those guys. His brothers are the worst, and I don't like them. Jason and Eric, they're assholes. They're so mean to him. They're mean to their wives. Like, he keeps telling his wife to shut up.
Yeah, Eric yells, shut up.
With a rifle in his hand. He's just like, shut up. Listen to me. I'm in charge of this family. Shut up.
That's improv, baby.
Yeah. And they get so intense in that scene that, okay, so when they decide that, okay, the aliens probably didn't find us, it's not a threat, they're like, well, let's go back to having the party, I guess.
Yeah, let's just act like nothing happened and sit down, and we're going to open some presents.
Michelle's going to open her presents.
Right, yeah. And this first movie, the little girl has almost no dialogue and fucking plays it cool.
Dude, she's
the whole time.
She's the most relaxed person in the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know if it was, she was told, I mean, she obviously was told to do that, but it's kind of unnerving, you know? It's like,
yeah,
but it also, that's the kind of one of the more unbelievable parts mm-hmm. of it is like, why is this 5-year-old girl the only one that's calm right now?
Yeah, wouldn't this 5-year-old girl be losing her shit?
Absolutely freaking out. Her parents are freaking out. So why wouldn't she be freaking out? You know?
It does also contain a little bit of an early version of the freaky but not scary kid trope in horror movies mm-hmm. That is usually illustrated by a kid who doesn't have a lot of friends drawing a weird picture of something that they saw. And she does that. She draws a picture of one of the aliens.
That's right. That's like the next thing that happens, because they're about to leave.
Yep.
Like Eric and his wife and her, they're about to leave. They're like, fuck it, we're just gonna go.
Yeah.
Out here. And then as soon as they leave, it's this really well-timed moment where the cameraman Mikey turns around. The family has walked out the front door and his mom runs right up to him. He's like, what is this? And it's a crayon drawing of a fucking alien head, like total communion.
Yeah.
The cover of Whitley Strieber's Communion.
The cover of Communion for sure. It's that image.
Yeah. And then they run back into the house. They tell him to come back in and she admits that she drew what she saw outside of the window.
Yeah.
So it's on after that. Like everyone's stuck.
Oh, and then there's an alien trying to come down the chimney.
Right. They're on the roof. Eric shoots one.
That's another example of the things that like kind of give it away that it's not real is the gunshot effects. They're definitely not going to be firing rifles in that house.
He shot it at the ceiling.
Yeah. There's no muzzle flash.
There's nothing. He hit the alien who was on the roof.
Yeah. And the sound is very clearly edited in. It's very clearly Foley.
But you gotta, I mean, put yourself in the time when this came out, you know what I mean? It was done really well.
Yeah, no, it's I love this movie.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was into it the whole time. I mean, it still holds up, even though I know it is fake. Or is it? I don't know.
Or is it?
But you know, there's like these attempts to get to the truck and they can't get to the truck. And then he shoots the alien and then he fucking brings it inside.
That's where it gets weird. Is like, wait, what? My favorite. So this stuff is all great because it's all classic siege horror stuff. It's Night of the Living Dead stuff. They like, you guys wait here. I'm going to get to the truck. I'm going to pull up the truck. I'm going to leave the motor running. You're going to run in and we're going to take, like, it's very Night of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. It's very like, that's the stuff you see in siege movies. And they do it really well.
Right.
And then when they shoot the alien, they go out and find the dead alien. And Mikey runs in to tell, Eric's wife that like, oh, he's bringing it in here. And this moment of realization on her face, she's just like, what?
Right. What? Yeah. It's so good.
And everyone's screaming at him, don't you fucking bring that thing in here.
Right. And his logic is ridiculous. And his wife calls him, he's like, his buddies are going to have to come find him in here. And that'll give us more time to like get away. And his wife's like, exactly. They're going to come in here.
Yeah. Like, what is wrong with you? Leave it out there.
And then he yells, shut up a few more times.
Yeah. Then he tells his wife to shut up a bunch more. Real cool dude, that Eric.
It's pretty ridiculous. But, you know, the way that they shot the alien being carried in, it's like from the side. You don't get to see, you see, you know, its head, but you don't see its full face. You kind of see it's the size of its body. It's small.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like he passes by. And again, like done believably well.
Yeah.
Even though it's fucking kind of a dumb move, but maybe that part of the narrative,
it's one of those choices,
sense, because it's so dumb. Who would do that?
It's one of those. Yeah, well, that's one of the thing. It's one of those choices that I love to see in genre films, where it's a character doing something that doesn't really make sense, but you know, in the heat of the moment of a thing, you could see it happening. And most importantly, it's a surprising thing.
Right.
It's a thing that you don't expect. And that's always a treat. I always like those little things where it's like, you know, this is kind of dumb, but hey, I haven't seen it 300 times before. So I like what I'm seeing right now. The problem for me is narratively, they never go back to it until, you know, the end. Mm-hmm. Like when they, it's always for me when they come back in after they shoot the alien and after Jason and Eric. So what happens next is Jason and Eric go running out to try to get the truck. Right.
Right. Yeah. And Mikey stays back with the family and he has the camera and the two older brothers are out.
And they're trying to calm Michelle down, which is funny because she's fine.
Right.
but then they're like, well, what's taking them so long? Right. Like they're not coming back. We don't know where they are. So they go running. One of them goes running out looking for them. I think it's Renee or whoever the other, Jamie. Right. One of them goes out running to look for them and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't think we ever see them again.
We never see them again. Jason and Eric are now gone, which I'm fine with because everything gets a lot calmer when Jason and Eric are out of the picture. When the two yelling dudes with guns are gone, everything's a little happier.
Right. Yeah. And then mom kind of she was kind of freaking out earlier on. You know, questioning the whole thing.
Yeah. And mom's an alcoholic, so they need to take it easy on her.
They do need to take it easy on her. But she kind of starts taking control at the end there, trying to calm everyone down.
She does. She takes back her house.
Yeah.
When her shitty sons are gone.
Yeah. And she gets everyone. One of my favorite lines is like, she's like, we need to sing or dance or play piano or tell stories.
But not ghost stories.
But no ghost stories.
Yeah. She's great.
Total improv, man.
Shirley McCullough is the name of that actor. Right. And I love her. She's so great. All of the stuff she says about, she says all this great mom shit about the camera when she's like, the mom doesn't understand how the camera works. She's like, how much power is that camera taking up or whatever? And it's like, none. It's batteries.
Yeah, it's a battery. And that's the thing. It's like it's all improv. So when she addresses that, Dean Alyota's got to say something. correct.
Yeah. And then I'm gonna wrap that goddamn camera around your neck.
Right.
So fucking great.
I love. But she sets them up pretty good too, because she'll say things like, well, like, what'd they look like? Or what did it look like? And one of the brothers responds, she's like, I don't know. What's a spaceship look like? And then it's like, she says something. It's like, I get real nervous when there's guns in the house. And the guy responds, I get real nervous when there's space things outside.
I might get that tattooed on me.
Oh, man. But then I can't remember who says it. Somebody says, well, maybe they can fly. And then I think it's one of the wives.
I think it's the mom. She says, if they needed to fly, why would they have a spaceship? If they could fly, why would they need a spaceship?
Exactly. That's mom.
There's a lot of that great improv stuff in there. And Shirley McCullough, the mom Van Heese, she even has this. And this is the thing I never believe is when they go back to playing, which is like, well, let's play Go Fish. And it's like, nobody's going to go look at the alien.
No one's paying attention to the alien.
No one's going to look at the alien corpse you have in the other room just to, like, I don't know, see what it looks like. Like, at the very least, one of those guys is checking its genitalia. At the very least, one of those guys is going to be like, I wonder what an alien dick looks like.
You got to know.
Yeah, you have to know.
Do they have nipples? Do they have a belly button? Do they got a butt crack? You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? How does an alien shit?
What do you... You gotta, I mean, it's really invasive, but you know,
it's so, I mean, it's, look, I'm not saying it's good.
No,
I'm not saying it's a healthy impulse, but somebody's going to do it.
Somebody's going to do it. There, you know,
an alien autopsy, you guys.
Yeah. It's, in their mind, they're either going to do it to them or we're going to do it. They're either going to do it to us or we're going to do it to them.
Yeah. Like, this alien bastard's been putting stuff in our buttholes. For a long time, I'm going to put something in an alien butthole.
If there is one.
But yeah. So But then she, it's like, I never really believed the go fish thing, but the mom has this whole thing she starts saying about, oh, we can wait. I can wait. We're just waiting for Jason and Eric to come back. And look, women know how to wait.
Right.
We wait on a boy to ask us out. We wait
That's
on
a, good
a
part,
man
yeah.
to ask us to marry him. We wait on a baby. We wait on a man to get home from work. Like, she has this whole thing about, like, her generation's,
right,
like the women of her generation and waiting. And it's kind of amazing.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't really sold on her at the very, very beginning of the movie, but she brought it home so yeah. hard with
yeah.
so many of those great lines. And, you know, each actor kind of got like a beat sheet and like a backstory mm-hmm. of their character and stuff.
And then they had to kind of fill yeah. the rest. Yeah.
And I don't know how much of this dialogue, I mean, it's probably 100% her, you know?
Yeah. Right. It very well could be. I mean, yeah. I don't know if they were told to talk about her alcoholism in the scenes alone. I believe that probably was on the beat sheet,
mm-hmm.
but that stuff's great too.
Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. It's like, that's like this dramatic kind of subplot or whatever. It's like, you know, we're as brothers, we're giving you shit, but seriously, real quick, like, what's up with mom's drinking, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that seems to play more of a part in the remake than the first one.
Yeah. Oh, the remake has so much, like,
it's so much
90s
more
sensationalism stuff in it. So much, like, you know, so right. many Jerry Springer subjects
right.
are in the remake.
Right. Yeah. We'll get to that. Cause it's definitely true. But you know, they sit down and they play go fish and the boys are gone. The older boys are gone, but you know, some weird shit starts happening. Like their watches have already stopped.
Yeah. The watches have stopped.
There's been,
well, like, they're hearing voices in their heads. They're getting headaches.
Exactly. There's mind control shit going on. And,
Renee. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. She starts to try to go outside.
Which is why. Don't
yeah.
do that.
And then everyone like runs to the door. Like, what are you doing? And she's just, her eyes are all glazed over. And
yeah. She doesn't remember that she was up walking around.
Yeah. She was being controlled. And then Ma tries the same thing.
Yeah. And mom's is even scarier because she's like, you don't hear that?
Yeah. Yeah. She's like,
they're saying, open the door.
Yeah. Did you hear them? You know?
Yeah.
And, but they're saying like, it wasn't scary. They're like, open the door and let us in. Everything will be all right. Like they were saying it calmly to them. That's
scarier.
That is scarier. And then Mikey, the cameraman, has the idea to turn the radio on, which is smart. He's got trying to scramble the
yeah I really I do there. I really like the let's turn the radio on to scramble their signal kind of thing. I
yeah
really
that's pretty
like
good
that.
Yeah, but you know, and so then the first time, all right, so at this moment where mom and Renee are kind of freaking out, just after that Mikey decides to go check on the alien in the room and it's fucking gone. And
it's gone
it's absolutely gone. And
Chekhov's alien corpse.
Yeah, and there's a fucking door in the room. There's a back door, and he got out the back door. So he runs back out, and there's another panic of them trying to get back in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I love the ending of this movie. And
the ending's great because the ending is definitely like sets up so much of what we see in found footage horror to come.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely invented
some
stuff here that still persists to this day, it seems. But yeah, he puts the camera down, and it's the first time we actually see Michael. And it's from behind. He just walks in front of the camera and walks into the kitchen. You just see him from the back. You don't ever see his face, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Because mom's yelling at him. Everyone's yelling at him the whole time to put the fucking camera down. And then he finally does,
but it's like at an angle and he doesn't right. turn it off.
Yeah, he doesn't turn it off. And it's it's kind of askew. It's pretty cool. It's like whatever, Batman, 60s yeah, Batman.
It's that, well, it's also that camera on its side thing at the end mm-hmm. of Blair Witch or so many other found footage movies where the cameraman drops the camera and that's how we know something bad happened to them.
Right.
Or whatever, you know.
But it's set up so you can see the hallway that's behind like a partition wall that mm-hmm. kind of blocks the hallway leading to the bedroom where the alien was to the kitchen, you know, or whatever. And man, I don't know if I'm confusing the remake with the original right now, but anyway, the aliens come inside,
yeah,
and two of them go into the kitchen. The people start freaking out, and the third one looks at the camera, and then the camera just cuts off. He cut the fucking camera off with his mind, and boom, that's it. Movie over.
Yeah, yeah. So I love that alien looking at the camera, and then it goes
so
out.
Good.
And there's like that the tracking, you know, the static.
Yep.
The static flashes that he used in a way that he thought was similar to John Williams' score in Jaws.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's his whole thing. Is that like he wanted to use these little flashes to kind of imply that there was a presence, you know, something right. was coming.
That's fucking cool, man.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So the movie is shot. They get it in the can. He actually gets distribution for it.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah. So, well, he has a hard time getting distribution for it. They do a screening in which Jacques Vallée attends, which is still so weird to me. And he has all these, he goes down to LA and he has all these meetings with distributors trying to secure some kind of distribution plan for the film. And no one likes it. Nobody's picking it up. People are throwing him out of their offices. People are throwing keys at him. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, this is a fucking shitty home movie, amateur nonsense, garbage. We don't want it. It's right. like just disrespect, you know? So, but finally, the last person they had a meeting with, I guess, this someone from Axiom Films decides to, they're going to release it. And they start putting together a distribution plan. And they, you know, they come up with art, promotional art and packaging. And they supposedly they send out some screeners to, cause there's going to be a DTV release, direct to video. And they set out screeners at this time. You would send screeners out to video stores to try and convince them to buy the movie so that they can rent it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I have theories about this, but so then Dean Alioto gets a call from someone from this rep from Axiom Films, or, you know, somebody at Axiom Films. I cannot find any information. This is another thing. I cannot find any information on Axiom Films outside of like a couple references to them in regards to this film. Whatever okay. this company is, there's another company called Axiom Films that was founded in 97 that is not associated with this company as far as I know.
Okay.
So there's a couple... This is one of the holes in the story.
Okay.
Anyway, he gets a call from somebody at Axiom. This person says, hey, things are not going great. The warehouse burned down.
God.
And the warehouse was housing the master tape and all the copies and all of the promotional art and all of the packaging. So the movie has been erased by a fire.
Ah.
And see? That's according to Dean Alioto, that was it. Like he also at one point did say that he suspected it was arson for tax reasons. For insurance reasons.
Yeah, which hey could be. But this is another thing where it's so weird how you can't find anything about Axiom, because if there was a big fire,
right? Right.
Why the fuck?
Why is there no story about this fire somewhere?
I mean, yeah, I don't know, but it just leads to it just lends to the lore.
Yeah.
Of the making of this movie and what the fuck it actually is. So this fire goes down, it's all burned up and it's gone. Like the movie's gone. He just has to eat it. He's just like, oh, that whole thing is done. Like I can't do shit. Yeah. It's gone. And then at least five years pass. Right.
Yeah, so I believe it's 1994. I believe it's early 1994 when this comes up, when Alioto gets a phone call from one Sean David Morton, who is a fascinating figure unto himself.
Okay.
He is either, I couldn't get verification, he is either currently or serving or recently released from serving a federal sentence. for gosh, civil securities fraud and tax fraud.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, he's so Sean David Morton and his wife.
He's a little cullion.
Sean David Morton fancies himself a psychic with remote viewing abilities.
Oh, okay.
And also claims that he was taught the secrets of time travel by Nepalese monks.
His name sounds so familiar to me.
He has referred to himself as America's prophet. I mean, he's one of these guys. This is where the story starts to become filled with characters.
Yeah,
you're going to recognize a lot of these names, I think.
Seems to be when the UFO community and a lot of conspiracy theorists started running with it. And it started becoming not just Dean Aliotta's little movie. It starts becoming like a much bigger deal.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
In real life.
Yeah. This is where the movie finds its own life, right, separate from its creator, and kind of like Frankenstein, you know. It's sort of like Dean Aliotta created this monster and then it ran out into the wild without him.
Right.
So he, in the last 5 years, without Dean Aliotta's knowledge, somehow a copy of this film entered circulation and it had the credits removed. So there was no way, it just looked like an actual home movie.
Yeah. And whoever did that is a fucking genius.
Yeah. So Dean Aliotta's theory is that it was somebody that worked at a video store, mm-hmm, who got one of these early screeners they sent. Here's the thing. I know that screener tapes, at least as early as the mid 90s, would have, you know, do like watermarks or do not, right, duplicate warnings that would come up on them.
Absolutely.
I can't say for sure if they were doing this in like 89 or 90. So I don't know, but there are no watermarks of the kind on any version of this film that I've seen, which sort of makes me doubt the screener copy theory. But again, it very well, they could have been, especially an outfit like Axiom, if they maybe weren't operating in a certain level, they might've just been sending copies that didn't have watermarks. I don't know.
And wouldn't you think Aliotta would have one of these copies?
Right. That, again, that's another thing, is that I don't know why he wouldn't have at least a copy.
Or anyone in the camp would have a copy, wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
I don't know.
He says he doesn't. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Or he said, for a while, he said that he didn't. Of course, he does now because the film has been, you know, resourced from one of these bootlegs or something.
Right. And he owns the rights to it.
And he does. Yeah. So, yeah. Because I can't find any other information about distribution rights. So he owns the rights. And went through, I guess, through American Genre Film Archive for this new release. But mm-hmm. So it could have been a screener copy. That's the most prevalent theory, I think, that a video store employee cut this credits off and then circulated it somewhere into the UFO community. And this is in 1993 when something even bigger happens with it.
Right.
Two men get their hands on it. Tom Dongo.
Oh yeah.
And retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Donald Ware.
Right.
Who these two guys are.
Something
gorgeous.
Else.
Yeah. So according to Tom Dongo, he was invited to a friend's house to watch it and became convinced of its authenticity and then started months of investigation, I mm-hmm. guess, to see if anyone else had seen it or to see if anyone else had a copy. And he couldn't find anyone. And this is, again, where it gets like weird to me, because it's like, surely someone else had to have, if, you know, whoever this friend, like, I want the name of the friend Tom Dongo got
right.
from, you know. Absolutely. I want to know who invited him over. I also want to know how Sean David Morton got wind of it. Well, I know how Sean David Morton got wind of it, but here's, again, so Donald M. Ware saw it as well. And then at the 1993 International UFO Congress Convention, mm-hmm. in, I believe, Laughlin, Nevada, Donald M. Ware and Tom Dongo, like, present this film. And Donald M. Ware is like totally vouching for its authenticity, like convinced that it's real.
Yeah, they're presenting this as a as an actual
evidence of evidence, a UFO abduction. Yes.
Yeah, which just, man, I mean, as a filmmaker who intended for that to be how it was received, you can't get any better than this.
Yeah, I mean, it's the guy, he wanted to make War of the Worlds, and then he did.
He wanted to make War of the Worlds on video, and everyone else did the footwork for him on selling it. Like, he's totally clueless that this is happening.
It's like, it's so crazy. Yeah, it's just, it's got a life of its own.
That's what you're saying. He's either the luckiest son of a bitch on the planet, or he's working with him.
Yeah, well, that's the thing too, right? Or maybe he, I mean, I don't want to make any allegations or anything, but it's not that hard to believe that a filmmaker who did research into UFOs and abduction stories and accounts in order to make this realistic looking War of the Worlds on video scenario, it's not beyond the realm of possibility,
right,
that he was savvy enough to say, okay, I've got my copy of this. The warehouse where the master was burned down is destroyed and they're not going to distribute it. I could just cut off the titles and send this out there. You know what I mean? I don't want to say that's what he did or that I think that's what he did, but like, there are just enough holes in the story that I'm like, maybe we're looking at the wrong conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it would be a genius move.
Right. It would be, I mean, like, I would respect him so much for that. That's William Castle shit.
But you have to be so patient and wait for the fervor to build to kind of unleash it at the right moment and just let this whole thing play out. You know, like, he waited years. If he was the one, the mastermind, he waited 5 years.
To
come out with this, like, oh, it actually didn't. There are copies floating around. That's crazy.
And like, this was a movie that had a crew. People worked on it. So
the
idea that nobody got a copy, because even if you're not getting paid, you're getting credit and copy.
Mm-hmm.
So someone had to have gotten a copy. Someone, maybe an editor. You know, maybe an assistant director. I don't. Maybe the guy that gave him the money, the $6,500 to begin with.
Yeah, you'd like to think he got a copy.
Yeah. So somebody somehow this got out there. It ended up at this UFO convention, Congress convention,
mm-hmm.
with a retired lieutenant colonel vouching for its authenticity. This is where Sean David Morton, America's prophet,
right?
this is where he saw it, and then somehow he tracked Dean Aliotto down. And this is another one of those instances where I'm like, somebody knew something.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dean Aliotto says he got a call from Sean David Morton, who he did not know previously, I guess.
Right.
Unless they met through Dean Aliotto's research into UFO phenomenon.
Right.
I don't know. But he gets this call from Sean David Morton, who says, hey, I want your opinion on this footage I found. And they basically tells him about the movie Dean Aliotto made.
Right.
And is asking him if he knows anything about it, which means somebody told, right? Like, somebody told him, oh, you know who you want to talk to about this is Dean Aliotto.
Yeah. He might know something about this. I don't know.
Yeah. Which is weird. Like, I don't know who connected those dots. It's again, it's missing information. And I don't have a tinfoil hat on right now. Like, I don't really think that there's some greater whatever, but it's just, it's a lot of weird coincidences.
Yeah.
It's a wild story.
Yeah. And Dean had to spend, he had to debunk like his own film.
Yeah. So this is what happened. Sean David Morton says, we have Unsolved Mysteries and Hard Copy and Encounters, all of these news magazine shows, especially the paranormal tabloid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They want to run a story on this footage. They're looking for it. They're looking for the story.
Right.
And that's when Dean Aliotto says, according to him, he was like, well, I guess Unsolved Mysteries is out.
Yeah.
And that's when Sean David Morton said, not necessarily, which is okay. That's how you know Sean David Morton is the guy he is.
Mm-hmm.
But they made a deal to go on Encounters. And that's when Dean Aliotto debunked on in an Encounters segment this story about UFO abduction, the McPherson tape. And it's a great segment. It's on, Dean Aliotto has it on his YouTube page.
Okay.
Indie Syndicate is the name of the YouTube channel, but the Encounters segment is on there and it's great.
Man, it's I should have asked you for the link, because I couldn't get to it because on the found footage critics or whatever website,
it doesn't work.
I couldn't get it to open, so I haven't seen it. So what's the segment like?
Oh, I thought I guess I didn't send you the link. That's the one where they're like, you Hall of Shame hoax.
Oh, you did. Oh my God. Okay. Well, let's explain it anyway.
It's so fun. It's there. The guy, the talking head guy, is like, not David Byrne, the host of the show, is like, you know, we understand why someone would want to hoax a UFO abduction story, but we don't know why. And then, or how, we don't know how they do it, whatever. And then the woman is like, it's the fucking on the UFO hoax Hall of Shame.
Yeah.
And they talk about this film, which is in the terrifying 60 minutes, you see a family under siege from aliens or whatever they say. And it's, they're describing the film and they're describing Tom Dongo and Donald M. Ware and how they came to find the film and how, you know, they, even the Encounters guys are like, it even fooled us, which is like, of course it did.
Yeah. absolutely.
But then they bring in Aliotto to debunk it and say, hey, this is the story. I made this movie. I set out to make this movie. And he kind of like, this is when he's embracing the War of the Worlds nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think now he's a little less so. He's a little more, you know, like, I wasn't trying to do that. I was just trying to make a movie. I wasn't trying to start anything.
Right. If he were a little more narcissistic, he could claim so much amazing shit.
Yeah.
You know, because like he says, he's the Forrest Gump of
found footage. It is the first purely found footage narrative horror film.
But I think he had a quote where he's like, it's a found footage.
Yeah, because it was lost.
film. Yeah. So it's like definitely the only found footage movie ever made, possibly. Pretty wild.
Yeah. So he's debunking that on the Encounters segment, which is, and a funny side note here too, is that the producer of this segment is a guy named Bob Kiviat. And Bob Kiviat is also, he's also worked for Unsolved Mysteries and a bunch of these other things as a producer. He's also the guy that like got his hands on the alien autopsy footage and turned that into something.
Okay.
Like, so Alien Autopsy Factor, he actually called Dean Aliotto about it before it went anywhere, because he was like, I've got this thing that you might want to be involved in. And Dean Aliotto was like, I guess like, no, I'm good.
He wanted him to be a consultant. Huh?
Yeah. He was like, that sounds like bullshit. I don't want to do it. And Bob Kiviat was like, well, I'm going to do it anyway.
Right. Aliotto doesn't seem to be interested in like the sleazy aspects of it. He just wants to tell the truth. No, like he's not trying to fool anybody really, but people got fooled
and they got fooled again too.
Yeah.
That's the thing is that Dean Aliotto, he now does a lot of work trying to debunk things and trying to like, he's very plugged into the UFOology community.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a lot. In some ways, it seems like he kind of fancies himself like a Harry Houdini type, because he goes around trying to expose the, you know, tell you what point to what you would look at to debunk something.
Right.
sorry.
It's all right, Andy.
But yeah, so he went through this twice. Like, he made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then through this Encounters segment, somebody he worked with when he was working for Stephen Cannell in television, because that's what happened. Dean Aliotto then went to work in television.
Okay.
And some television producer he knew there had seen the Encounters segment, was like, let me see the movie. And Dean Aliotto showed it to him. And then this guy was like, oh, we can we can make something with this. Mm-hmm. Like, we can remake this into something big.
Right.
And this is still before the Blair Witch Project and Last Broadcast.
Yeah. I mean, this remake came out a year before Blair Witch did. So yeah. Both of Aliotto's movies are predecessors to the biggest found footage film of all time, you know?
Yeah. He was the first twice.
Yeah. The first twice. And, and you know, Blair Witch, Cloverfield, all these movies borrow these tools of his that he employed in these films, yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's totally trailblazing here.
So this producer he worked with, then they started shopping it around. And at first they were going to go with Showtime, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then it fell through. Anyway, Dick Clark Productions picked it up.
Right.
Which is huge.
Huge. I remember at the end and I saw the Dick Clark Productions little jingle and logo and shit. I was like, holy fuck. I saw that all growing up on so many shows. And I couldn't believe that this was associated with Dick Clark Productions.
And then Dick Clark, that's deep pockets too. So they took it to UPN and Dick Clark gave him $1.25 million budget.
Right.
Which is, I mean, kind of a step up from $6,500.
Kind, just a small step. Yeah.
He says,
small step for man.
Aliotto said, one of the many, I've listened to many podcasts that he's been on. And on one of them, he did talk. He was like, I had like kind of an anxiety attack because I didn't know what to do with that kind of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, that's the lowest budget movie that, you know, that's like a tier zero. Yeah,
it's like nothing, but
shit show of a movie. But yeah, for him, that's like, that's where he was in his career. That's huge. And, you know, it'd be huge for anyone just getting started like that.
And they shot it in Canada where, where the dollar stretches a little more. So it was, I guess it worked out to like $1.5 million.
Right. And he still came in under budget.
He still came on not just under budget, $500,000 under budget.
Damn, that's crazy. Yeah, that's a lot.
Nuts.
That's nuts. That's a producer's dream right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I can see why he started getting a lot of documentary work after this.
Right.
So he goes up there, he shoots, you know, the remake, Alien Abduction Incident in Lake County.
Right.
And it's starring Emmanuel Shariki from Entourage.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like, she's definitely in it. And I knew I recognized her. She's so young because it was her first movie, right?
It was her first thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You had to tell me that was her. I was like, oh fuck. Okay. I knew I recognized her. Yeah.
She's great in it. The cast is pretty fun. It's like, it's a little bit more, I mean, it's not a birthday party this time. It's Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we're deep into the 90s now. So it's like, there's cattle mutilation. One of the brothers has a drug problem. There's a race thing where
the older brother's slightly racist.
Yeah. The older brother's racist against the sister's new boyfriend. Like like I said, there's a lot of afternoon talk show shit going on in this movie. A lot of real edgy 90s stuff.
Right. And the mom in this one is a legit drunk. Like she's, she's drinking hard the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just a thing they talk about.
Yeah.
It's
and they kind of have, right. And they kind of actually have a blow up about it a little bit, but the cameraman, whose name is it's Tommy this time.
Tommy McPherson.
Yeah, he's more of a shit talker in this one. Like he stands up for himself.
He stands up for himself a lot more. Yeah.
Yeah. But the old
he's also kind of a creep.
Oh yeah, because he films.
Yeah, he spies on his brother and his brother's girlfriend.
Yeah, having sex. Ugh. And he films her naked body.
And then he says, "I deleted it," and he definitely did not delete it.
Yeah, he was filming while he was telling him he was deleting it.
But not so he's cool, like Tommy.
Not cool. He's a 16-year-old scumbag at a, you know. But he wants to be a music video director. That's his whole excuse for never cutting the camera off.
Yeah.
Because again, everyone's yelling at him to cut the camera off.
Yeah. But I don't know. The line about like you spent your inheritance on a camera, it's like, whoa, that's a little much. And the dad is. It's his dad. Is it his dad or his older brother? I think it's still his older brother, right?
Kurt, his older brother?
Kurt, yeah. The guy that's carving the turkey. Because, okay, so I have to admit, it's been longer since I've seen this one.
Okay.
I mean, I did find it the other day, but I didn't rewatch it entirely.
Right. Well, I got to admit, too, I watched it, but there are two segments. In the link that I'm going to post, because it's the only one I can find. Yeah, the segments, I think 5 and 9 out of 10 can't be played in America.
Wow. I wonder which. So it's not the cattle mutilation, right? You've seen that. You see that, right?
Well, I saw that when they mentioned the cattle mutilation and like run away.
Yeah. I mean, you don't actually see
much.
Yeah.
No. But. I don't know. I mean, I obviously don't know what happened in the segments, but I watched the whole movie. And I was like, all right, there are some major holes here.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just going to fill it in best I can, you know, because it's essentially the same plot.
Yeah. It's the exact same thing. It's the
exact same movie.
They even play Go Fish.
Yeah, they even play Go Fish at the end. But there's more. You actually see Tommy, the cameraman, the little brother. You actually see his face.
Yeah, yeah.
Multiple times, and there's different the watches stop again. That's the thing that happens. But then there's more. The aliens are attacking them in different ways in this movie too, and there's like actual fights. There's a fight in the house with one of the aliens.
Yeah. Some of the alien action stuff in this one is great.
It is actually pretty good.
And yeah.
The middle brother gets shot in the hand with like a laser.
I love that.
And they show his hand. There's actually practical like makeup special effects in this.
Yeah, they used an FX team that worked on the X-Files for this.
Right, and they're the same team that built the spaceship for this one too, and they had a much bigger budget. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, his hand got charred a little bit, and then, you know, towards the end, all the ladies are getting like these burning lesions on their neck, and you see them. And then, Kurt, at one point when he's fighting the alien upstairs, gets a nosebleed, you know, so they're like getting in their heads, and they're, I don't know, blasting some sort of frequency that is making them scream. They're very uncomfortable sonic warfare stuff, I think. So yeah, they're getting attacked. Appliances are cutting on and off at random. The power's cutting on and off at random. They're really fucking with them more in this.
And
they're actually firing at them. Like you see these red kind of laser lights coming in and kind of hurting them.
The moment when the aliens see them in this one is a lot more intense.
Yeah, because there's an actual transformer blowing up on a telephone pole.
Yeah.
And that's what they find. It's a much shorter walk, by the way, this time to the spaceship.
Yeah. I can't remember if there's any fart jokes in the remake when they're walking spaceship.
I don't.
But there are in the original.
Yeah. When he tries to fart on the lantern, he's like, remember when we used to do that?
Great.
Every young boy knows exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
They see the spaceship, they see the aliens, and then he's talking about how they're going up to the cowl and they're starting to cut into the cowl. And that's when they spot the guys.
Yeah.
They bust the aliens just totally in the middle of a mutilation.
Of a mutilation. Yeah, that's not cool. Get away from that cow, aliens, you fuckers.
That's my neighbor's cow.
Yeah. What are you doing? What if this is like a Cowboys versus Aliens thing? You know, these cattle rustling aliens.
Yeah. You don't fuck with the man's cow, Andy.
No, you do not. Absolutely. Especially if you're an alien, you know?
Yes.
Not even from this planet. Get out of here. These are Earth cows. You got your own.
You don't come into this planet and fuck with the man's cow.
Yeah. Welcome to Earth.
Yeah. All you're gonna see is us screaming and running away. That's how we're gonna defend the cow.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
I'll fucking fight an alien for a cow any day. Try me, bitch.
Oh man. There's not much plot wise to get into. Other, you know, they added a sister who has a boyfriend who is a black man who. Kurt is slightly upset that his sister didn't tell him
That, I'm just going to say Kurt sucks, period. He, I can't decide if I hate Kurt or Eric more, but I hate them both.
I think Kurt's worse than Eric.
You're right. Because Eric, if Eric's a bigot, we don't know it.
Right, exactly. But he comes out with it. Yeah, you said it's Jerry Springer shit. It's like late 90s hot button issues stuff. And
I'm surprised they don't talk about abortion. Do they talk? Maybe they do. I don't know. I don't remember.
I couldn't see two segments, so I really don't know.
Yeah, you missed the whole abortion segment where they just talk about, it's like everybody stops and they're just, you know, where do you stand on this issue? And
that's,
you know, Kurt's like, well, as a Catholic, I have to say, and then everyone groans.
That's they're trying to get back to normal while there's a dead alien upstairs conversation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I missed it. Too bad.
Let's make the kids feel better. Time to talk about abortion.
Let's normalize the situation. Fight like a family.
Yeah, and then we'll tell ghost stories, but not ghost stories.
But not no ghost stories. So another facet to this remake is they kind of intercut these little interview segments with like cops, like a cop and a fucking anthropologist and a musician, a British musician who has been abducted, and he calls them like big headed wankers.
Yeah.
And it's like this whole video brought all my memories come running back. And then there's a filmmaker named Damien Hawkins.
Yes. Who is played by Dean Alioto.
Right. So he's in the film again. He kind of has his Hitchcock moment in a way, but
that's his cameo.
He's got dialogue and he makes this funny comment. He's like, if it is a hoax, I should have been the one that directed it.
Yeah. He's like, I know it's not a hoax because no one, you know, I would know. And I'm the one that would do it if it were like, okay. Yeah. I get it. That's funny.
Right. So the remake, higher production value, worse actors, even though they cost more, they weren't, as far as I know, improv actors. They were actors who, a couple of them actually became like real actors with IMDb pages, which tells you that it was a movie. So
yeah,
we'll get into that in a bit because people still think this is real.
Yeah. They're all very Canadian too. Like that's, they shot it in Vancouver.
Right.
And it's supposed to take place in Minnesota. I guess that's because that's the state where, you know, everybody sounds the most Canadian.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah,
that makes sense. I don't know. It's funny.
Far north Minnesota.
The first movie takes place in Connecticut, but was shot in Northern California. This movie takes place in Minnesota, was shot in Vancouver, Canada, British Columbia. And they had a jar for like when the Canadian actors, if they said something that sounded too Canadian, it was like a swear jar.
Yeah.
But they had to put money for sounding too Canadian.
Yeah, he had to call him out and be like, what's that all about, you know?
What's
like,
that about?
Yeah, fucking don't quit saying you're sorry and fucking fix it, you know?
Yeah. it's they filmed it in Canada, and then while they're filming it, there's a complete regime change at UPN.
Right.
And all the people that were excited about it are gone.
Yeah, no one's excited about it anymore.
And the only guy that was still there when they agreed to do it, as far as, you know, the decision makers go, is a guy named John Levop.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. So they come back, complete regime change at UPN. They don't know where they stand. UPN does a screening of this movie that they were excited about and are no longer excited about. And that one guy, John Levop, told Dean Alioto that in that screening, the executives were all pissed. It was like the worst screening they've ever had.
Was it UPN's first movie, TV movie?
Yes. Production? It was UPN's first production, television movie production.
So they were super bummed. They didn't want to they didn't want to introduce themselves that way. They were pissed.
Yeah. So they ended up still doing it, but they did what you do, right? When you have something that you don't care about anymore, you dump it.
Right.
So they dumped it to a Sunday. I found two different sources that say two different dates. One says Sunday, January 18th. The other says Tuesday, January 20th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read it was a Tuesday.
Yeah. Either way, it's not good, right. where they put it. And they didn't, I guess they didn't promote it very much. So people didn't know it was coming.
They
didn't want to waste more money on it.
They just wanted to fulfill the obligation to air it.
Exactly.
They didn't give a fuck about anything else. Just get it out there. We've already spent enough money on it, and let's leave it so I can taillights, you know?
Exactly. So they put it on after, shit, I can't remember what the actual title is. Something like Real Vampires.
Oh, Vampires Exposed or something like that?
Yeah, Vampires Exposed. Yeah, the like a fact or fiction, I think, subtitle type thing to it. But yeah, Vampires Exposed.
Yeah, and so that led viewers to believe, because that was presented as yes. like kind of a real reality kind of situation.
Yeah.
And then this comes on.
Yeah. Which, by the way, doesn't have a disclaimer saying that this is fiction.
Right.
Instead, they do that. They lean into it where they say, like, this is real footage. Mm-hmm. No, they say if this footage is real, it's up for you to decide.
Right.
Like, they don't know that it's fake.
Yeah, because the original has this, they start out the movie talking about Project Blue Book and the history of Project Blue Book.
Yeah. Well, and it even has another name. They call it the Northwoods UFO Case 77.
Right. Yeah. It's footage from that case. That's it's uncut footage from this.
From Northwoods that case, UFO in, case. In the, as a file in the Blue Book. Yeah.
Well, it's called Northwoods UFO Case 77, which is kind of weird because that makes you believe it's 1977, but it was supposedly shot in 1983.
Yeah, it's like,
but the real movie was shot in 1988, so fucking crazy, whatever. It's and there's McPherson's when there's no McPherson's, and whatever.
Yeah, it's exactly. Look, there's things that don't add up, man.
There's things that don't add up.
There's question marks that don't have exclamation points to them yet.
There is a person or a dozen or more with the largest homemade cork board you've ever seen about a subscribe and save fucking Amazon order of index cards and Sharpie pens and yarn.
Yeah.
And
just
and pin and push pins. You know what I mean? Just losing their fucking mind over this.
Forever. Cause there's a lot I mean, we're not even done. That's the thing. There's still more to this. So they screen it, they dump it, they run it after the vampire show. Also, it ends with a phone number for you to call.
Right. They should legitimately play it off. Like, it's silence and it's fading in and out to headshots, pictures of every single person that's gone missing. And then call this number if you have any information.
Yeah. And they did it. UPN did an online poll. And the thing is, the show was a success.
Yeah. It was like the highest rated show of the night, right? Or the week
something.
Or whatever.
But it was success for them, and people thought it was real.
Right.
Even though that did end up with credits, like, nobody watches that. They just see the phone number and they're like, oh, it's real.
Yeah. But people still think it's real.
Yeah. To this day, gosh, we're old, but
yeah.
22 years later. 23 years later? Oh my God. 23 years later.
Yeah, that's when I graduated high school, man.
Oh my God, me too. Oh wow.
What have we done with our lives, Andy?
Nothing. I mean, we didn't make this movie, that's for sure.
Look at us. We're just here talking about it. That's how far we've come.
You know what? I'll take it.
I'll take it too. We've plateaued.
But 49% of the people back then, I guess, that were polled on the online poll that UPN conducted, supposedly, believed that it was real.
Yeah, they believed it was fucking real.
And it's partly because they also did cut in at some point, they cut in all of these other interviews into it with members of the field. There's Yvonne Smith, who is, by the way, I looked a lot of these people up and a lot of them are connected in some weird ways. Yvonne Smith, who is a motivational hypnotist.
Oh,
Daryl Sims, who is a self-described alien hunter and hypnotherapist. Dr. Stanton Friedman, who's like a huge name.
Oh, yeah. Stanton Friedman's huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
He if his name's attached to this being real, a lot of people are going to follow that.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, is that he also went on Coast to Coast at one point and was asked about it. And I think he didn't understand what he was being asked about or something. Dean Alioto says he doesn't think that Friedman understood what was being asked, but he like basically talked about it as if it was real.
Dean Alioto is the luckiest son of a bitch. He's got, right. He's got fucking Stanton Friedman out there putting it out that, yeah, this is legit. And this is the remake, like even the shittier one.
Yeah, well, I think that when Friedman was talking about it, he was talking about the original.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense to me. One. Yeah. That makes way more sense to me.
So, yeah. God, what's the one? There was another really funny thing to me that was about. Oh, gosh. Oh, okay. So I went to Don Ware's retired Lieutenant Colonel Donald Ware, who might be dead now. I don't know. The last time his webpage was updated, it said he was 80.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a while ago, I think.
Okay.
But his website is great. It's like truthseeker.something. But he mentions both Yvonne Smith and Daryl Sims, who were on this in like a description of a later International UFO Congress convention that he went to, mm-hmm. where he's like got notes about the whole event. And Yvonne Smith did this thing that I think is really cool. She put on an open mic for experiencers,
mm-hmm.
like people that had been abducted or had encounters, would go up and just talk about them in an open mic fashion. Can you imagine like doing that at a bar?
No,
like, I don't. Like I ran comedy open mics and poetry and music open mics for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, this is the only way I would do another open mic.
Yeah. I mean, depending on where you are, that could be a long fucking night.
Yeah. Right. Oh man. Yeah. Yeah.
And into the next day. I mean, when's it going to end?
Hopefully before, you know, that hour, what is that, 4 a.m. or whatever, when aliens always abduct people?
Yeah.
Hopefully it ends before that.
Yeah, the gray hour.
Yeah, at that same convention, Daryl Sims, apparently in his lecture, said that abductees should stop whining and get over it.
Oh, my. Whoa.
Really stood out to me as a thing to say.
Wow, that's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. But so Ware also has this, he's the guy that in the video said that if they were actors, they ought to get an Oscar.
Okay.
he's also with Tom Dongo, one of those people that believed that when Alioto debunked the film the first time,
mm-hmm.
they did not believe him.
Right.
I do not know where either of them stand now, but in that encounter segment, they both go on record saying they do not believe that Dean Alioto is telling the truth when he says the film is not real.
Right.
And he brings up the government's capacity for what he calls inserting disinformation
mm-hmm.
into UFO stories. And I think that's really interesting that he's like, this is why I don't believe Dean Alioto. I believe that the government just does this. He right. also has a movie called UFO Chronicles, The Shadow World.
Okay.
And I just got Peacock and that's where it is. So I'm going to watch it.
Okay.
And this is a fun thing about him. He reminds me, when I think of Donald Ware, he doesn't look anything like this guy, but for some reason I always think of the major from Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
Major Garland Briggs. Man. Played by Don S. Davis, who actually played Scully's dad in an episode of The X-Files, or in multiple episodes of The X-Files.
Yeah, it's deep.
And Dr. Jacoby from Twin Peaks, played by Russ Tamblyn, is actually based on Terrence McKenna, who is another yeah. who is another one of these figures.
Yeah.
So I just think it's fun. I always wonder if, like, is Garland Briggs based on Donald Ware? Like, what's the story there?
That'd be great.
I
wouldn't doubt it.
Anyway. Yeah. And Tom Dongo is the one that's like, I think parts of it are fake, but parts of it are true. And it's like, wait, what? Yeah. What are you talking about? Why would there be?
So the idea of this whole conspiracy is, and this is like a quote, I think. Yeah, this is a quote from Alioto. He says, news channels did exposés on the movie and people started believing that the original VHS footage was real and that the government had hired me to make the TV remake as part of a disinformation campaign to discredit the original.
Yeah, that's my favorite part.
I don't even understand.
So the idea is that the original footage is actually true. It's actual genuine footage. Mm-hmm. And Dean Alioto was hired by the government to come in and take credit for it, saying it was a fictional film.
Okay.
And saying, and then when not enough people believed that, then they said, okay, remake it. So that way, when people search for this tape, they find this movie and then they can say, well, that's obviously fake because it was on TV and made by an actual production company and has a cast and crew and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. Because the original film didn't have credits on it. So there was no way, you know what I mean? There was right. no, and the thing is that this theory is super complicated.
Right.
Right. There's even people that cite that because there was a mayor of San Francisco whose last name was Alioto, that Dean Alioto must be related to that mayor somehow. And there's a political tie.
I mean, San Francisco is a part of the story, which is interesting too.
Yeah, but according to Dean Alioto, there's no relation. But it's the thing is, there are just enough holes
right
in all of it for it to kind of be like, okay, I don't believe it, but it makes sense as a theory.
Well, isn't it kind of interesting that the conspiracy theory is that the remake is to discredit the first, and like when people look for the original, they'll find the remake and whatever. And the whole McPherson tape thing,
exactly. Like
they both go by the same name now.
Exactly.
So if this title. Conspiracy, if this conspiracy were perpetrated by the government, it worked.
Yeah. Right. It's like, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, just the fact that the title doesn't really match up and doesn't even have a coherent history behind it of when that title started being used. It's like, that actually gives credence to this theory that it was both that the remake was designed to interfere with the legacy of the original.
Right.
You know, like that, it's that stuff. The fact that nobody knows where the first video came from.
Right.
The fact that, you know, there's not this much information on Axiom Films, all of these other weird connections in there too, that just kind of, I don't know. There's weirdness going on.
Yeah, man. I mean, it could be the US government behind it all from the very beginning, or it could be aliens. Whatever aliens are involved with this video are the aliens that abducted the family, the Van Hees family. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that leaked the tape, man. They're the ones.
The aliens leaked it.
That got it out there.
Yeah.
They're like, never forget. I know, it's over, but it's
here's
not.
Here's the thing. It. One of those aliens is just like really into, like they were really involved in the late 80s, early 90s underground bootleg tape trading communities. Mm-hmm. And look, he had a ton. He was really into like German gore stuff, like Category 3 Hong Kong stuff. You know, the hardcore stuff you had to be in a tape trading circle to get to. And he was just like, oh man, there's a videotape here. This guy shot all this. I can use this to trade with somebody and get that new guinea pig movie. Mm-hmm. Or something like, aliens are into weird shit.
Aliens are into weird shit. Well, the aliens themselves, and this is part of his own self debunking thing, is he's posted a photo of the three little girls in the original that were hired to play the aliens.
Yeah,
they're in costume with their head, the alien heads sitting on their laps, and he says they were 10 to 12 year old girls.
Yeah.
And he claims he's still got one of the heads from the production. Yeah. Everything else is basically destroyed. He might have like part of the alien outfits and that's about it. He's posted these photos and he's like, yeah, this is all bullshit, but people still persist. Like, nope.
Yeah. To be clear, I do not believe for one second that it's real. Like there are so many things in the production. I mean, the story is all murky. And has some things that are like ripe for conspiracy theory.
Yeah. I think it's just legitimately a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's stuff in the film while you're watching it where it's like, when he says this isn't a porno,
that right.
Aliotto tends to forget, I think, while he's making the movie a couple times that he's making a movie, or that he's not supposed to let you on to the fact that he's making a movie, because he uses like industry terms sometimes, or not necessarily industry terms, but like cinema language terms. Mm-hmm. Where, like, for example, saying this is not a porno, and then one of the actors catches him and says, "It's not a movie, it's a birthday party." Like he's I think it's this actor cleverly being like, "Hey, you're breaking the fourth wall a little bit here by saying this isn't a porno when you film two people kissing."
Right.
Like, but I think in Dean Aliotto's mind, it was just like, "Oh, this is what a 16-year-old with a video camera would say."
Right.
And I get that. But he also, at one point, there's that flash of light in the window, you know, and he says there's a flash in the background, which is...
Oh, yeah. I don't really notice that. Yeah.
I don't know that he would say background if this was real. Like,
if he weren't in the...
If he's not
on a
looking
movie
at,
set. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's just, you know, there's the alien corpse thing, too, where it's like, I don't believe for 1 second they're not going to go check out that corpse. Like, it's a movie. It's a fictional narrative film.
Yeah, it definitely is 100% a movie. But it just, I love, and I feel for them in their own way, but when people go down these huge rabbit holes, these conspiracy holes, when there's, I mean, the guy who created it is telling you, I created it, and you're like, nope. Like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
It's like, you know, like you're super religious and God comes down. It's like, yeah, I'm God. And they're like, nope. I know. And it's not you, you know, but I'm telling you. And you're like, nope.
Yeah, it's so weird. That
not what I had in my mind. This isn't what I had in my mind. So it's not. No.
Yeah. Well, people find these narratives that are convenient or support a larger perspective that they have. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those perspectives are tied into community or identity in really severe ways. And so the only thing they can do is dig their heels in, no matter what evidence they are faced with of that narrative being false. If it's the foundation in any way or shares any load bearing responsibility for that sense of belonging,
mm-hmm.
and that perspective, like they're going to dig their heels in and fight that evidence until the death. Like they're going to just be like, no, I don't believe you.
That's a good point. And then there's like this whole web sleuth community where, you know, people were looking into true crime and I don't know if you watched that Hotel Cecil documentary, and you kind of get annoyed at how far a lot of them can take it just to not let go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And admit that, okay, I have zero proof, but whatever. But I still have a hard time telling anyone that they're wrong, like that they're not necessarily on to something. The only time I would do that is if they were coming after me.
Yeah,
I'd be like, no. I mean, I know the only thing I know 100% for sure is you're full of shit because that's about me. Otherwise, I can't really say.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the thing is that he does say that because that's the thing where that's what he does now, right? Is he's a debunker. And it's not just for his film. Like he goes to UFO Congress conventions now.
Crazy.
And the same convention where his film was showed in 1993, as if it were actual footage, he goes to those now and like makes presentations. And he like is available for speaking gigs, and he does podcast interviews where he goes into online forums and stuff, I guess, and tries to tell people like, no, this is the truth. But he is at a point now, I guess, where he's like, there's some people that aren't going to be convinced. Mm-hmm. I've heard him say that in interviews, and it's just like, well, we'll let them have it, I guess, because they're not hurting anybody. But
yeah,
I mean,
this whole
thing is right. It is like hard to say how big a leap it is from stuff like that to fucking QAnon shit.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, this whole thing happened behind his back. Everything, the conspiracies, the popularity of his own film. Unless
he circulated the tape himself. Like, again, I don't know.
See, I mean, to me, the real conspiracy has nothing to do with whether or not this is real film. It's the story of how the film came to light and the history of the distribution of it and his role in it. That's the...
It's so interesting.
That's the interesting, sketchy part. Like, the film is a movie. We all very obviously, both of them are very obviously a movie. His role in it is the whatever. I mean, believe him or not, I don't know. I don't know the man. I don't really know. I believe him when he says he had no part in this. But then, you know, in that one interview, he's like, I do have pay stubs from the U.S. government. But that's just for like some promo shit that I've done for them. And I believe that. I mean, that's probably true. He probably does. He probably did shoot some promo videos for the U.S. government. And but, you know, to anyone looking into him.
Well, yeah, it could look like, oh, well, this is just a guy that worked for the history or for the Discovery Channel.
He's on the payroll.
They just hired. Yeah.
So, that's I don't know, man. This guy stepped into some shit. He stepped into some like crazy shit that he just created. There's so many layers. It's amazing. Yeah. It's so fucking amazing. Like, not only did he create this groundbreaking, totally innovative movie that has inspired like franchises and there's a whole genre.
Well,
that
it's inspired
so much
them
money
by...
off of his ideas.
Yeah, it's hard to say what that inspired because it's like it didn't get a proper release, so it's not like a lot of people saw it. Although Joe Cornish supposedly saw it and it inspired him, and that's the guy that made Attack the Block. So
I haven't seen that.
Oh, you haven't seen? It's so good. It's so much fun.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look at that now.
It's a movie. I think you'll love it. I think you'll love Attack the Block.
In your episode of your show about this movie, there Ghost Watch. I've never seen that. I don't know what that is.
Ghost Watch is so good.
But there's a lot of these found footage films that I've never seen. But the ones that Alioto claims to have influenced is Blair Witch has the confessional moment, which was in the remake. He claims that basically, even though it's like probably the worst part of the movie, the remake.
But I mean, even that could have arguably been inspired by reality television, which was already several years strong at this point.
Yeah. And he says he spent a lot of time in reality television.
Yeah.
He did work in that.
But so he was hip to it.
But he also mentions Cloverfield, which came way later. Just using the story of it all starts at a party and then a blackout, and then there's a panic of stuff you can't see, and it's shot in a very similar manner.
Yeah.
So I believe that. I believe this, and those are huge, obviously huge movies, and they had to have drawn influence from this. And they had
even before his film though, there was a movie called The Stone Tape. From the 70s that is, it's more of like a Ghost Watch thing than a UFO abduction thing. But it is, it's technically found footage. It's not quite in the same way that this is, but it's, there's a lot of these examples out there. The fact that he drew inspiration for this from War of the Worlds, it's the thing that always amazes me is just how long it took for this idea you have broken through,
right,
to make something like this as a narrative feature,
right,
that tells a story and does all the things that genre films are supposed to do. It's interesting. It always amazes me that it took that long, and I think there are a lot of reasons for that, but it's also crazy too to think that the technically first one to do it also went unseen really for years and years and years after it was made.
Yeah. And it could have something to do with the equipment available and how light it is.
Yeah. That's the big thing, right? Is that for so long to make a movie, film until video came along, you really couldn't make something like this.
No, this 8mm camera has a microphone. It's a camera. It's your sound source. It's your lighting source, all in one, and it's light, for the time. So it's like,
and there's a film. There's David Holtzman's Diary is a film that does it with film, long before, but it's also not horror, and it's like a more of like the personal narrative thing. It's not really a narrative film, but it is fiction. It is telling a story, a fictional story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more of a character study though than anything else. But it's, yeah, you need this, the durability of video. You need the durability of video and the portability of video to allow you the freedom to make something like this. Yeah, especially the lighting. I mean, lighting alone is just like,
right.
Yeah, you can't take a fucking film camera out into the woods at night with no, you know,
no
extra light source.
No. And you know, with the remake, he shot it on digital. Whatever, mm-hmm. It was like a late 90s, so whatever digital video, he had the newest thing again. And he doesn't really like that remake because he says it was overlit.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, it looks legit in terms of, I mean, whatever, like the lighting inside the house and whatever, but.
Well, right. That's like the thing, is that the believability is the key with a film like this.
It has to look like. If it's, it has to look like someone is legitimately just shooting off the cuff. And I'm going to quote you from your own podcast. You said, if it looks too good, you don't believe it.
Exactly. If it's too well lit, all of the things that normally, it's this weird counter standard that we have where in a narrative, regular traditional format film, believability means not having the fourth wall broken.
Mm-hmm.
It means not seeing the artifice. It means not seeing the tools that create this. If a boom dips into frame, you're reminded that this is a movie. If it's not well lit, you know, like all of these things that aid your suspension of disbelief in a narrative film are completely the opposite in found footage.
Mm-hmm.
Like you need to see the artifice, you need to see the instruments of it. You need to, the fourth wall needs to be broken.
Right.
The person holding the camera needs to be addressed.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It's, yeah, for it to be believable. Yeah, you're right. If it looks too good, you don't buy it. And that's what he's totally right about that. The remake isn't as successful as the original in that regard.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it reminds me of Dogma films too, you know?
Yes. Yes.
This is kind of like the celebration in the sense that it's a party that goes awry, but it's not obviously a very, very different story.
Well, and there's quotidian, you know, it even is connected to Italian neorealism
mm-hmm.
in that way, in that you have to see the banalities in a person's life for it to feel real.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, he has to zoom in on the food. They have to talk about, you know, him not, fixing the leak.
Yeah.
They have to make jokes about him having a camera to begin with.
Yeah. It's just like everyday minutia, man. Just like, it's gotta be full. It's gotta be just whatever. It's gotta be like a real fucking conversation. And that's the thing. There's a lot of, everyone's talking over each other. And that's as real as it gets. That's as real as it gets. Like that's how my family talks.
That scene, especially at the beginning, when they're all having like three different conversations.
Yeah, that's real as real as it gets, man. And it's it might be annoying, but it's that's the whole point. It's supposed to you're supposed to be watching. This is like total voyeurism.
Yeah.
This is
like, hey, man, that's the stuff we celebrate Robert Altman for too.
Yeah, you
know? Like
absolutely. Yeah, and it's great. And, you know, he had lightning in a bottle in that first UFO abduction film. They fucking nailed it. Everyone involved just nailed that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
It really is good, man. I mean, it really is. The remake, of course. One thing I did like about the remake was they made, her name is Rosie, the five-year-old girl. She was like a conduit for the aliens.
Yes. They took the creepy kid thing. And applied the new dynamics of it in the genre. Right.
Yeah, whereas the original, like we said, she was super silent and kind of calm the whole time, didn't say hardly anything. In the remake, she was huge in the plot and in the movie. And she was communicating with them. They were communicating with her.
Yeah.
She was helping them.
Yeah, she's almost like the bad version of Elliot. You know, for me too. It's like,
She got taken over. She was being manipulated, and she like let them in at the end. I think that was the idea, is she like let them in. And, you know, I didn't see, I guess there was an alternate ending to the remake. which is the one I guess I saw, which is, you know, the like she's like, I got stuff to do. And they're like trying to play Go Fish. And I think that's when she sneaks out and opens the door. And then the aliens come in and they go into the kitchen. And the third one looks at the camera and like raises its hand to it. And then that's what cuts it off.
Oh, yeah.
But that I read, but I haven't seen that the original ending is the cameraman, Tommy, I think. And yeah, the remake comes face to face with an alien and like drops the camera. And kind of goes into a trance, and then it kind of goes to static, and that's it.
Oh, weird. Because I've seen the one you've seen then.
Okay. Well, I read about the ending I just talked about where Tommy dropped the camera and came face to face. And on the, I think it's the Wikipedia page for the remake, it says that the ending where they come into the kitchen, like the original movie, that was the alternate ending for the remake.
Huh.
That's what it says, man. I mean, I don't fucking
know. I mean, it's also possible that if they aired it more than once, you know, UPN was such a young network at the time. Well, not really. I mean, they've been around for a couple years.
They had chopped a bunch of shit off. Years. They had chopped a bunch of time off of the movie when they didn't want to air it. So yeah. I think when they did
that. And they also added new interviews. So.
Yeah, they were. I think when it got a little popular, they were adding stuff in.
I could see that. Because they definitely aired it more than once.
Yeah, well, it did well for them, I guess. I don't know, man.
Well, it did well for Dean Aliotta, I guess. I mean, because he's leaning into all of this now.
Yeah,
at the time he'd gone through this twice, right? And he's like, ah, fuck it, I'm done. And he decided he wasn't going to work in the genre anymore.
But at the 2016 interview I heard, he was wanting to get back in. He was
saying, and he is getting back in. He's kind of doing like he's doing the thing that everybody in LA does,
mm-hmm.
or everybody in the industry does, I should say, where it's like you're trying to put all your iron, you got a handful of irons, and you're trying to put them in as many different fires as you can.
I was going to say cocaine.
Oh, that too, probably. I don't know. He's look, he's svelte. I don't know if that's coke. You know, maybe
hey, it could be.
I don't want to speculate, but he's doing a lot of stuff. He's trying. I guess in 2019, he made another alien horror movie called Portal.
Okay.
That I have not seen, but I am eager to.
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
He also is trying to launch. He's got some of these like promotional videos out there, and he's got a website, deanaliotta.com, but he's talking about this network he's trying to start called Alien Content, which is just like you need someone to name things for you. like UFO abduction, I get it. It's direct, it's to the point, but it's also a nightmare to Google.
Yeah, absolutely. Because so, there's another movie from like 8 years ago called
Alien Abduction. It's also found footage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not so, it has nothing to do with Dean Aliotta.
So it's just like Dean. Baby, I love you, but you need to workshop some of these name ideas because alien content is not cutting it. It's not cutting it. Call it Area 77 or something like that. Or, you know, I don't know. The Northwoods, come up with a name, but not alien content.
Yeah. It's just alienshit.com.
And on that, he's talks about a reality series he wants to do called Alien Evidence, which again, buddy, let's work that out.
Not very creative, this guy. Well, I mean, he is creative, but maybe not with his words.
It's funny too, because the idea of alien content is that he wants to make, wait for it, alien content.
Oh.
He wants to make science fiction and horror shows about aliens and alien abductions and alien encounters, but also have behind the scenes footage going so that he can produce documentaries and supplemental material on the making of this alien content, mm-hmm. almost as a way to like say, hey, this is how we do it. Right. Like he's still trying to debunk, but another one of this, he wants to do a series called Dark Side of the Moon, which is a little better, but also something that's been used a million times as a title.
Bunch. Yep.
He wants to do a third movie in the abduction trilogy.
Okay.
This one, I think, is just called Incident in Lake County, which is, again,
Dean. It's going to be so confusing to search this stuff.
and you know that at some point they're all just going to be called McPherson tape.
I was going to say, yeah, this is, it's just going to be the McPherson tape.
Yeah, that's what people are going to do with it again. So he wants to make Incident in Lake County, which is the third, you know, the closing film in the trilogy, which is also weird because the films aren't narratively connected.
Not at all.
Trilogy-wise. No. And then, oh, this show called Skylar's Alien Abduction Blog about an indie drummer barista in L.A.
Oh.
Who has alien experiences, I guess.
All right.
That sounds kind of interesting.
I mean, I wanted to hate it when you said it, but
right,
it's kind of interesting.
Here's the thing. Here's the things that make me hate it. Indie drummer, barista, yeah. L.A.
Right. Yeah.
I don't care about any of those.
Me either. But when you, it seems like some out of touch older man trying to figure out what's hip.
Yeah.
And then just throw aliens in there.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a good version of it, probably, you know? You give him a fun, like, you know, celebrity friend that's maybe like a B-lister now. Maybe somebody a little out of fashion as like a sidekick or something. I'd watch, you know, you give me, I don't know. I'm trying to think of who I'd cast in that role, the sidekick role.
Fucking Ham from The Sandlot, man.
Oh, dude, for sure.
Get that guy. I forget his real name.
Yeah, or, I mean, literally any cast member from The Sandlot.
Anyone. Any one of them.
Any one of them.
Bring back Benny the Jet Rodriguez.
Yeah, that guy. He's a firefighter,
right? Yeah, bring him out of retirement.
Bring him in. Have him fight aliens with your barista drummer.
Yeah, Benny the Jetpack Rodriguez.
Yeah, get Jesse Gee to design the weaponry that he is.
Yeah, man, that'd be sweet. The barista and his buddy fighting aliens.
Yeah, but he's also he's heavily involved in the ufology community and the skeptic community to some degree. He's working on a documentary, I guess, that he wants to do with Nick Pope and Travis Walton from the Fire in the Sky case.
Right.
And he's involved with all of these people. And he's still doing the debunking. There's, I guess, a handful of videos that he believes are genuine.
Okay.
I don't know if you know the Go Fast, the Pentagon videos, right? The naval ones, the Go Fast, Gimbal, and what's the other one called? The FLIR?
I'm terrible with names. I don't know.
He believed the ones that the Pentagon are basically declassified or whatever and said, like, yeah, these are legit. He believes those. He believes the 2004 Mexican fighter pilot footage is genuine.
So he believes all the legit military footage that he sees.
Yeah.
Well, not like, all of it, but.
Is he just saying that because his bosses are saying it?
You know? I don't know, man. I mean, it's a credible source. That's the thing. Like, you know, you gotta look at these things seriously. I mean, I believe them until, you know, there's a reason not to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, especially those ones. I don't know. They
yeah,
it's kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I didn't know he was that big into the UFO community, especially in the capacity that he is.
I didn't either.
His role in it is very interesting.
I think it's kind of recent that he's gotten this involved. Although, again, Jacques Vallée and went to his first screening. Like, he did research on this stuff initially.
Right.
You know, Sean David Morton, again, like somebody who was at one point a big name in paranormal phenomenon communities and circles, like, you know, turned out to be a piece of shit that was taking money from investors for his economic predictions and then funneling them into his own shell companies. But whatever. He was plugged in to some degree, and now he's like even more plugged into this scene. And it's like, it looks like he's like really leaning into it and trying to be like, well, this is my thing.
Yeah, he found his niche, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe he'll make his third movie and it will be the actual definitive proof of aliens.
That'd be fucking sick, man. Maybe
just accidentally films real aliens coming while he's shooting his movie.
But the thing is, he's been sitting on it forever. He's like, I've had this. This is some real found footage. This is like,
yeah.
All right. You've seen my first two films, but this, is for real.
This is for real, for real.
Yeah, he could really sell it.
I mean, no one would believe him because he's cried wolf so many times.
Yeah. Yeah, man. He's too honest to be believed.
Yeah.
It's weird. I do like how he talks about people would reach out to him after it came out, about when people started believing that these films were real, they would reach out to him to help stop alien abductions from occurring.
Oh, wow.
And he says like, oh man, there's like a little cottage industry that I kind of missed out on there. I kind of missed the boat on. So it's nice to see that he found his place in the community. Cause seems like he's got some regrets and now he's like jumping on it.
Yeah. He's jumping on it hard.
Good, but good for him.
I mean, look, I'm all for alien content. I just want the name to change.
Yeah.
I just don't get that as a name. And also, who knows where he's at, you know, post COVID. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he went back to his home planet.
I was going to say. Yeah, he's
maybe
fine.
He was at the Capitol. No, I don't think so. He's not. He's not that kind.
You don't want to get into that. I hope not. Well, shit, Andy, I think we covered it, man. What do you think?
I think so too. I had a lot of fun. I think it's the story of this film, these films, is the story is so wild. I love it. And I love sharing it with people.
Yeah, man. It's great. And I'm glad you brought it up to me because I didn't know what it was. And if anyone wants a pretty in-depth look into it and the history of found footage films in general, we've got to check out Andy's podcast, Ghoul School, a horror history podcast. Like I said, first episode is about this exact, it's about this exact thing, basically.
Yeah.
But other than that podcast, is there anything else you got going on you want to talk about?
I got another podcast I'm starting.
Okay.
Called Look Good for the Boys.
All right.
It's a horror gossip podcast. And I know you don't know what that means.
Okay.
That's fine because I do. So just listen to it. The first episode will be out soon. I don't know how to describe it. It's like if Svengoolie and Elvira hosted The View, I guess maybe, but it was also like kind of high school. I don't know how to describe it actually. I think you should just listen to it, especially if you're a horror fan who's into geeking out about little things, little tiny minutiae in the genre, and especially if you're LGBTQ horror fan. I think there's a lot for you to enjoy in it.
Okay. And you got co-hosts or?
Yes, I co-hosted with Philip Johnson.
Oh.
CSF's own Philip Johnson.
Oh, damn. Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
And what's up, Phil?
Yeah. I'll tell him you say hi.
Tell him I said hi.
I will.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. We should actually just start a whole podcast network that's just for CSF podcasters.
That seems like it's going to be a thing here.
Yeah. I mean, no actual successful ones are allowed, though.
Like, no, if you get too big, it's like Gilman Street. Get too big, you're not allowed.
Yeah, exactly. Will Harper, I'm sorry, you're too big, baby.
Get out of here.
You take your accolades and you enjoy them, but you're not on our network. I'm just kidding. I love Will so much that he's allowed.
He doesn't get an invite.
Will gets an invite. Annie Letterman doesn't. Annie Letterman's too successful. She can't be on our network.
Too successful. You're out.
You're out.
Get out of here.
Who else is out? Is there anyone else that's successful?
Nick
Petrie, you're out.
Nick Petrie's out. All the Beirut boys, you're gone.
Yeah, no more Beirut on our network.
Ryan McNeely, you're out of here.
Yeah. I feel like there's somebody else.
Let's just say Trevor Crist. Trevor Crist, you're gone.
Yeah, just because.
Just because.
Just because. You're out of here. You're out of here, Trevor. Ari Aster didn't go there when we did, but he's out too.
And he's out. Fuck him.
Ryan Stout, you only went there for a semester. Same goes for you, Macklemore.
Oh, yeah, Macklemore, you're gone, buddy. We don't want you.
Macklemore's not allowed.
Yeah, nothing to do with you. Not on our network.
Not on our network.
We don't want success.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
So that's what I'm doing.
Well, shit, man. Hopefully that's what I'll be doing too. So
yeah. So listen to Look Good for the Boys and Ghoul School. I'm also occasionally, I do segments for my friend's podcast, Bunk 237, which you should listen to anyway, because it's just great. And occasionally I pop up on there.
Awesome.
The other thing I'm doing is looking for my paper that I wrote in high school so that I can bring it on here.
Oh yeah. What is that? The paper about UFOs, right?
Yeah, I did a paper on UFOs that I feel like you could critique it.
Hmm.
This was in high school. I was 14 when I wrote this.
I would love to read this on air and talk about it.
It's 20 pages long.
Oh yeah, we got a whole episode critiquing this paper. I would love to.
Yeah.
So next time you're on, you got to find this, and that's the whole next episode.
Yeah, that'll be it.
Fuck yeah. Well, thank you, Andy. Thanks for being here, man. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's a lot of fun. I'm glad to get to talk to you again.
Yeah, man. It's been a while.
Yeah.
We'll continue to stay in touch because, I mean, that's what friendship's all about.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Andy Sell, I'll talk to you later, man.
Dinges.
All right. Later.
Bye.
Bye. All right, there it is. There it was. Andy Sell and myself. Really fun conversation. I'm going to post links on the website, lostrhetoric.com, to both movies and links to some articles that you can check out and come to your own conclusions. So definitely check that out and, you know, look into it. It's fun. It was a fun one to research. And both movies are worth a watch, I think. I hope you enjoy them. And also on the website, check out the shop, check out the merch. If you like anything you see, buy it. And check out the Spotify playlist. That'll be on the website as well. Please get on Apple Podcasts, rate, review. And like I said in the intro, please share a link to your friends, share an episode, say something, recommend the show. I would greatly appreciate it. You can find me on Instagram at Lost Rhetoric Podcast, on Twitter at Lost_Rhetoric, or old school email, LostRhetoricPodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you about anything. Write me, contact me. And that's it. That's it for the week, folks. And please check out Andy's podcast, Ghoul School, a horror history podcast. It's worth your time. And I'm looking forward to his new show that's coming up. And I'll, like I said, I'll post links to everything he's got going on in the show notes. So get on the website and check it out. All right, everyone. That's it for the week. I love you all. I'll see you next week. And until then, please stay sane. Stay safe.